From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, a domestic assault conviction should have stopped Devin Kelly from purchasing the rifle he used in the Texas church. Why it didn't. And the president versus the courts. It's Tuesday, November 7th. Dave, yesterday we learned that the shooter at the church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, Devin Kelly, was a member of the Air Force. What are we learning about the circumstances under which he left the Air Force?
So he wasn't in the Air Force for very long. He joined in 2009.
Dave Phillips covers the military for the Times.
And by 2012, he was in deep trouble. He'd been court-martialed for assaulting his wife and his stepson, his infant stepson, and actually broke the baby's skull.
Hmm. What more do you know about the assault?
We know that he pled guilty, said that he did it intentionally. He served 12 months, or at least was sentenced to 12 months of detention. And then afterwards, he was kicked out with what's called a bad conduct discharge, which is next to the worst discharge you can get. It's one above dishonorable.
So just to be clear, after this alleged conduct towards his wife and stepson, he is sentenced to 12 months within the military system, and he is discharged with bad conduct. Did he have a different kind of criminal record because this played out inside the military than it would have if it had been a civilian system?
I think so. I think to a large extent, the civilian world doesn't really understand and communicate well with the military court system.
Hmm.
So in this case, he was charged with what in the civilian world we would have called felony-level assault. And so the fact that this guy had a court-martial conviction doesn't always translate so that people understand he's a convicted felon. That conviction also didn't get into the federal databases that would have kept him from owning a firearm. And so in that way, it is hugely significant. The fact that he pled guilty to intentionally harming his wife and stepchild, any type of domestic violence charge should have made him ineligible.
Dave, what have we learned about what happened to Kelly after he left the military with this bad conduct discharge?
So he gets kicked out, and it's finally finalized in 2014 that he's out of the military. During that time, he's bounced around a little bit. He very briefly taught at a little Bible school down near Corpus Christi, just volunteering. He got divorced. Mm. He got remarried in 2014. And we don't have a good track on what he was doing exactly, but we know that one of the few places that he showed up anywhere in the public record was that he registered to vote in 2014 in Colorado Springs, and he gave his address as this little RV park where he had lived in slot number 60. This trailer park's only a few miles from where I live, so I very quickly got in the car and went out there. It's this kind of shabby little trailer park right on the edge of the mountains, just a gravel lot, really, with a couple pretty tired-looking elm trees around the edges. And at this point, since it's getting on winter, there's not a whole lot of trailers there, but about a third of the trailers are kind of too decrepit to move.
Hmm.
And so I started asking around, you know, had you seen this guy? Had you seen that guy? The funny thing is, when a reporter shows up at a place like one of those RV parks, we basically look like cops and are treated as such.
Hmm.
So no one really wanted to talk about it if they remembered. And it's a pretty transient place, so maybe they didn't. But then on my way back, I happened to stop in the laundromat of the RV park and found this one woman. She gave her name as Susan. She happened to live right next to spot number 60, where Mr. Kelly lived with his then new wife, his second wife, in the summer of 2014. And I asked her, what do you remember about this guy? And she said, you know, not much. He wasn't particularly friendly, nor was he unfriendly. There's just one thing that she said really stuck out in her mind, and that's the dog that he kept. So this dog, it was a puppy, and he kept it tied outside on a rope. And this RV park does not have much shade at all. And so Susan would look out of her trailer and see this dog just sitting in the sun in August without water or with its rope tangled up around the bottom of the trailer there. And she felt bad about it and went out and would give it water and untangle it. And then one day, neighbors called the police because they saw Mr. Kelly punching the dog repeatedly. Mm. The police came and there was a standoff where he was locked in his trailer. He wouldn't come out. The police waited for over an hour. Eventually, he came out and they cited him for animal abuse and he pled guilty to that. A few weeks later, he was gone from the trailer park and the next thing we know, he's back in Texas.
Does the animal cruelty case that you're describing and that it sounds like was adjudicated in the court system, does that end up registering with the police or the courts in a way that would make it harder for Kelly to own a gun?
No. Something interesting happens. So this is a misdemeanor case. He never gets the dog back. But what happens is he's given what's called a deferred sentence. If he stays out of trouble for 12 months, any record of the offense is erased. And so by 2015, when he completed this deferred sentence, it was gone. It's like it never existed.
And what do we know about the past few months leading up to Sunday?
Well, we know that over about the past year or so, like everybody else, he's got a ton of friends on Facebook that are his old high school friends. Mm-hmm. People who knew him back when they described him as a nice kid, maybe a little awkward, but kind, good sense of humor. They all start unfriending him because this guy who had been raised going to church, who had worked as a volunteer at a Bible school, he suddenly started publishing all these anti-Christian or atheist screeds and rants and kind of picking fights with people on Facebook to the point where one after another, a lot of his friends simply unfriended him.
Because they were offended.
Yeah. I haven't seen any of these posts. His page has been taken down. But over and over, people say they were inappropriate or just boorish, the types of things that were just meant to insult or incite.
So Kelly developed anti-Christian views, but why do we think he targeted this particular church in this particular town?
Yeah, this is about an hour from his house. So it's a good question how he ended up there. Law enforcement is saying that their best guess is that this is because his current wife, the one that he married after he got divorced, but he is now estranged to, a woman named Danielle Lee Shields. It's her family's church. She attended sometimes. So did her mother. So did her grandmother. Mm-hmm. The police are calling it a domestic situation, but they haven't given us any more detail other than they're investigating threatening texts that he sent to his mother-in-law.
Do we know if the shooter's in-laws were in the church when he went there and killed 26 people?
What we know now, we don't have a full list of who was in the church, but it is being reported that his wife's grandmother was in the church and was killed.
Dave, based on everything that you've told us about Kelly's convictions from 2014, and in addition, this local animal cruelty case in Colorado Springs, how did he actually buy the guns he was carrying and used in Sunday's attack in the church?
Yeah, we always talk about loopholes. There are these ways that you can fly under the radar and buy a gun that sidestep federal safeguards. Mm-hmm. You can buy a gun out of the back of someone's car. You can buy a gun at a gun show, and it will never go through the federal database. But what looks like happens here is there was no loophole. He went to the local gun store, and he bought a gun. And they checked his name, and it was clear. He shouldn't have been able to buy a gun. With his conviction, it should have flagged him, and they would have said, hey, thank you very much, but we're not selling you anything today. But he fell through the cracks. Maybe it's because the Air Force didn't communicate its conviction to the national database. Maybe it's because, for one reason or another, the national database misunderstood what the military conviction meant. But for whatever reason, he got a gun. In fact, he got several guns.
Dave, thank you. Appreciate it.
Sure, no problem.
On Monday evening, the Air Force admitted that it had failed to enter Kelly's domestic violence conviction into the federal database, which could have prevented Kelly from buying the rifle used in the attack. In a statement, the Air Force said it will conduct a complete review of Devin Kelly's case and of their entire database to, quote, ensure records in other cases have been reported correctly. We'll be right back.
We start with breaking news. Reports from New York say that several people have been injured in an incident in New York City.
Eight people are dead, 11 others injured after a man drives a rented truck onto a crowded bike
path in Lower Manhattan. Details are still emerging. Was it deliberate, and are there links to terrorism?
The deadliest terror attack here in New York City since 9/11. The suspect.
Last Tuesday, about an hour and a half after Saifullah Saipov drove a truck into a Manhattan bike lane, President Trump responded to the attack.
Meanwhile, President Trump responded to the terror attack on Twitter, saying, quote, my thoughts, condolences, and prayers to the victims and families of the New York City terrorist attack. God and your country.
So it starts with condolences, as you'd expect.
Adam Liptak spoke to our colleague, Sabrina Tavernisi, about a pattern that is emerging with the president.
And then it takes a turn.
Trump is calling for the execution of the suspect who authorities say
he starts talking about the death penalty in the justice system.
18 dozen more. Tweeting shortly before midnight, he killed eight people, badly injured 12, should get death penalty.
All right, so I just want to stop right here for a second because this is just so important. We always talk
if
about
he's calling for the death penalty for someone who has not yet been convicted and who is cloaked in the presumption of innocence, he has the potential to really prejudice the jury pool and make it much harder, actually, for his side to pick jurors who might be sympathetic to President Trump's point of view. So a juror would be asked, have you seen anything about this case? Is there anything that would influence you about this case? Did you see President Trump's tweets? Did you vote for President Trump? Well, I might think you're not qualified to be on the jury because you may have prejudged the case.
And Adam, how is that bad for the prosecution versus the defense?
It's the Trump voter and the Trump Twitter follower who is more likely to be pro-prosecution. And it's those people who may be thought to be infected and prejudiced by the president's comments and those people who might be kept off the jury.
Got it.
So what we've been seeing in several legal cases is President Trump making statements about pending legal proceedings that may well undermine his ability to accomplish what he wants to achieve by letting people use his statements in opposition to his policies and in their own defense in cases before they're tried, asserting that their constitutional rights had been violated by the president's statements.
On Friday, Bergdahl avoided a prison sentence of 14 years for desertion and misbehavior before the enemy.
And what about Bo Bergdahl? What did the president say about that case initially?
So as a candidate, he says quite extreme things.
We're tired of Sergeant Bergdahl, who's a traitor. He's a traitor, a no-good traitor, who should have been executed.
But he's only a candidate. He becomes president, and he alludes to his earlier comments.
They're setting up sentencing, so I'm not going to comment on him, but I think people have heard my comments in the past.
The military judge handling the case indicated that the comments were problematic and that he was going to take account of them in figuring out the right sentence. He was, in the legal terminology, going to consider the president's comments as mitigating evidence. And he may well have done that.
Sergeant Bo Bergdahl leaving court today in civilian clothes, free but dishonorably discharged.
Friday, we learned that Bergdahl is not going to be punished beyond dishonorable discharge and some reduction in pay and so on, but he's not going to serve additional time.
So just to pause on that, you're saying this is a case where his words had real legal power, had bearing on that sentencing.
The judge said as much, and bear in mind that each of these cases is slightly different. In the case of Saipov, he is trying to influence an independent branch of the government. And that's a separation of powers problem, and people may have issues with that. In the Bergdahl case, he is the commander in chief. The military justice system reports to him, and he may be trying to influence that system in a much more direct way, which is problematic for its own reasons.
Adam, I want to read you what Bo Bergdahl's defense attorney said after the sentencing on Friday. He said, quote,
President Trump's unprincipled effort to stoke a lynch mob atmosphere while seeking our nation's highest office has cast a dark cloud over the case. Every American should be offended by his assault on the fair administration of justice and his disdain for basic constitutional rights.
So that's a defense lawyer making that point, a defense lawyer whose client may well have benefited from President Trump's statements. That statement is not out of keeping with how a lot of defense lawyers are reacting to the president's statements.
Right.
Even when they might get some benefit from them, they nonetheless are very uncomfortable with the idea that the president of the United States is trying to intercede in particular legal cases.
So this reminds me of other incidents you've talked about, Adam, like the travel ban.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
Where during the campaign, Trump called for a complete shutdown of Muslims entering the country.
Until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Then he softened those words as president, but it's the original wording that's being used in the legal case against the ban. Is that right?
Well, President Trump's statements and tweets about the so-called Muslim ban have had a great effect in the travel ban litigation.
The administration is trying to get a hold on the ban lifted. The judges repeatedly brought up the president's comments about a Muslim ban during last year's campaign.
And courts have routinely looked to what he said on the campaign trail and as president to interpret those travel bans, which on their face may be neutral, may be acceptable, but these courts have found that, in fact, they were animated by religious discrimination. Why? Because President Trump said so.
Would this be potentially an opportunity to anybody in the legal system?
Well, I mean, in one sense, yes. I mean, the people challenged in the travel ban have been aided by the president's comments. Bo Bergdahl may well have been aided by the president's comments. For all we know, Saipov will be aided by the jury he gets, or perhaps even make the argument that they should take the death penalty off the table because you can't find an unbiased jury. So in that sense, people have been aided. The other sense in which the president's comments probably help him are with his base. There are people who think that the justice system is riddled with technicalities that let people off who shouldn't get off, and those people may welcome these kinds of comments.
Adam, is it unusual for a president to do this? And what are the historical precedents for this?
Well, I can think of two.
I have a question. Are you guilty of any murders? Are you guilty of plotting any murders?
I killed a chicken once.
Any human being?
No.
So President Nixon, during the notorious trial of Charles Manson, opined that he was guilty.
On his way back to Washington from San Clemente today, President Nixon stopped in Denver to talk to a meeting of law enforcement officials, and then he called a news conference where he charged that Charles Manson, who is on trial for his life in Los Angeles, is guilty, directly or indirectly, of 8 murders.
And that prompted Manson's lawyers immediately to move for a mistrial because the president of the United States was influencing the course of the trial. And President Nixon, himself a lawyer, recognized his error and walked the comment back.
A few minutes later, his press secretary called back and said he was retracting the president's statement because he had failed in referring to Manson, failed to use the word alleged. But by then, the trial in Los Angeles had been thrown into a small uproar.
And then you can look to the Oklahoma City bombing, where President Clinton and Attorney General Reno said that they would seek the death penalty for those convicted of the crime.
The bombing in Oklahoma City was an attack on innocent children and defenseless citizens. It was an act of cowardice, and it was evil.
If death occurs, the death penalty is available, and we will seek it.
That sort of sounds like it's in the same zone of what, as what we've been talking about, but not really, because they presumed that the system should work. And then they said, if it does work and someone is convicted, the crime was heinous enough that they would seek the death penalty. What the Trump tweets say kind of leapfrogs the first part and says, this guy deserves the death penalty now. And it's a pity we have to go through the rigmarole of an actual trial.
So in saying and tweeting these things, is the president putting the justice system through kind of like a kind of stress test? I mean, that you know, the justice system really is the institution at the heart of the democratic process, and he's testing it in a way.
Yeah, that's one way to think about it, Sabrina. I think that just as he's attacked the legitimacy and credibility of news organizations, he seems to be going after an independent judiciary and causing people to think that it can't be trusted to get things right. He's changing the climate. He's changing the tone. These are important enough instances in themselves, but they also may represent the beginning of a very big shift in the way we think about the judicial system.
You know, the saddest thing is that because I'm the President of the United States, I am not supposed to be involved with the Justice Department. I'm not supposed to be involved with the FBI. I'm not supposed to be doing the kind of things that I would love to be doing. And I'm very frustrated by it. I look at what's happening with the Justice Department.
Thank you so much, Adam Liptak.
Great to be here, Sabrina.
Here's what else you need to know today. Saudi Arabia is accusing Iran of committing an act of war, increasing tensions between two of the Middle East's most powerful enemies, and raising the possibility of armed conflict. Saudi Arabia blames Iran for supplying a neighboring country, Yemen, with a missile that was fired at the Saudi capital of Riyadh over the weekend and intercepted by Saudi anti-missile technology. Iranian leaders deny any role in the missile attack and accuse Saudi Arabia of, quote, wars of aggression, regional bullying, destabilizing behavior, and risky provocations. And over the weekend, it was reported that Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky was attacked outside of his home as he stepped off his riding lawnmower, leaving him with 5 broken ribs and bruises to his lung. The Times is now reporting that the altercation was with a next-door neighbor, Rene Boucher, over a landscaping dispute involving their yards. Aides to Paul say that because of his injuries, it is unclear when he will be able to return to work. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.